Last week, this is long expected, isn't it? The ban on gay marriage, or put more properly, the amendment to the Missouri Constitution that defined marriage as a man and a woman went into effect last week. We're going to be talking about that here in the first part of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're also going to be talking a little bit later in this hour with Uwe Simonetto. One of the things we're going to discuss is Christianity in Iraq and why the leaders in Iraq want the Christians to stay, the Christians who are in Iraq, to stay in Iraq. We'll be talking about that with Uwe Simonetto in the latter part of this hour during a religion roundup. It's been a while since we've had Uwe on. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It is the 7th of September already. And joining us first will be Vicki Hartzler of the Coalition to Protect Marriage in Missouri. We'll talk about that constitutional amendment that went into effect last week. Then, in the second hour of the program, Ken Samples joins us of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center, part one of a three-part series we're going to be doing with Ken on answering the objections of unbelievers. Today, we're going to deal with the basics, like the existence of God. We'll also talk a bit with him about the creeds. Are they merely things of the past? And, you know, we don't, as Christians, we take this for granted, but people in other parts of the world find it hard to think of God being both transcendent and immanent. We'll be talking about that with Ken in the second hour of the program. Then in the third hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll hear from President George W. Bush. Were you satisfied? He didn't mention abortion by name, but he did talk about making a place for the unborn child. And although he did not mention the word gay marriage or same-sex marriage, he did indicate his support for keeping marriage as an institution between a man and a woman in his address Thursday night at the Democratic National Convention in New York. Were you satisfied? I saw someone the next day in the parking lot at the grocery store. I said, they approached my window. We're previous acquaintance. I said, did you hear the president's speech? Did you hear? He mentioned abortion, not by name, but he mentioned protecting the unborn. He mentioned gay marriage, not by name, but he talked about, well, saving traditional marriage of a man and a woman from activist judges. Was that enough for you? We'll be talking about that in the third hour of the program. Also, a question about Alan Keyes and his recent comments about the daughter of Vice President Dick Cheney. She is lesbian. Alan Keyes made some statements you don't often hear. You don't often hear from someone who's running for the Senate about homosexuality. He made it on a gay radio network. We're going to be looking over what he had to say. And the question I have for you regarding that is this the way to talk about homosexuality in the public square? Take aside the issue of Alan Keyes as a prospective senator or as a candidate for Senate in Illinois. He's a Roman Catholic, a Christian, who has very strongly held beliefs based upon Holy Scripture about homosexuality. Is this the way Christians should make the case about homosexuality in the public square? We'll talk about all of that in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Vicki Hartzler is our guest here in the first few minutes. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Vicki is spokesperson for the Coalition to Protect Marriage in Missouri. Vicki, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, Pastor.
Give us a review of what this, how this amendment to the Missouri Constitution came to be and what its enactment means for Missourians.
Well, what it means is that our current state policy that recognizes marriages between a man and woman is protected from legal challenge. And this all started after we saw what happened to the people of Massachusetts, when just four liberal court judges were able to override the will of the people and to mandate that gay marriages would take place in their state, totally against the will of the people, against the will of the legislature. And we saw that our current state constitution was vulnerable here, and the same thing could happen here that happened there. And so, thankfully, our legislature took proactive steps to put this out before the people of this state to amend our constitution, to shore it up, to protect it from a legal challenge, and we are very thankful for the victory that God gave us on August 3rd. So now our constitution is protected where it was not before, and I think what happened the day after the election proves that what we were saying was needed all along, the opposition kept saying that, well, we have a state law here in Missouri. We don't need to put it in the Constitution. But the day after our election, a Washington State Superior Court judge ruled that their state law was unconstitutional because it was not in their state constitution, the exact scenario that could have happened here. And so all of our efforts were validated by that, and the people of Missouri can now rest more assured that traditional marriage will be upheld here in our state.
What kind of reaction has been received in the month since what was then and still now considered an overwhelming vote in favor of the Missouri constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage? What kind of reaction from the homosexual activist community?
Well, they were bewildered. Some of their quotes were kind of interesting. They just were very baffled. One of their leaders said that I think this shows that I don't really understand the way that the average Missourian is thinking out there, and that all of the arguments that I tried to put out just didn't stick. And I think they just don't understand that people value traditional marriage, that the vast majority of Missourians do believe in God. They fear God. They think God had a good plan to begin with, and they don't want to see it thrown out for an untested social experiment. They don't understand the role of faith in people's community, as well as just the common sense social policy, a public policy, which this is, a wise public policy. But it's been wonderful to see the reaction across the nation to our vote here, too, because our state, we're the show-me state, and on August 3rd, I'm thankful to say that we were able to show the rest of this nation that here in Missouri, marriage matters. And I think it's sent shockwaves across this country. I was called and interviewed by papers all over this country, from the Los Angeles Times to the New York Times to the Atlanta paper to Utah to just on and on. And people wanted to know. They just said, this is a huge landslide victory. How did this happen? Why did this happen? And bottom line, I say, is because of prayer. People prayed. People got out and voted their values. And they took a stand. And they're tired of judicial activism. They're tired of their will being overrided by a few elite judges imposing a liberal agenda on them. And when people have the say, have an opportunity to have a say, they will come out in support of marriage.
In that connection, you talk about judicial activism. That was the tack that the president took Thursday last week at the Republican National Convention when he did mention marriage and traditional marriage. He said, and I quote, I'd like your reaction, because the union of a man and a woman deserves an honored place in our society, I support the protection of marriage against activist judges. I will continue to appoint federal judges who know the difference between personal opinion and the strict interpretation of the law. Did he frame the subject there to your satisfaction?
Oh, absolutely. That is exactly the right-on-target argument that needs to be made from a public policy standpoint. And as president of our country, he both has taken the moral high road in his personal life, and as he has expressed his faith and that he believes that his actions are based on faith and prayer. But then from a public standpoint and a policy standpoint, we need to ensure that judicial activism doesn't override the will of the people, and that it's a good public policy. You know, a lot of people, the opposition, kept trying to say that this is a religious matter, and religion, people have different views on religion and things like that. And when you're debating this in the public square with people who don't have a religious background, you need to stick with that this is good public policy, in my opinion.
What about, some may have heard about a possible challenge by the ACLU of Eastern Missouri. Do you know anything about this, Vicki?
I have not heard anything about that.
Now, I'm wondering also your reaction to something that was said in the paper right alongside a quote from you. Jeff Wunroe, executive director of Promo, a St. Louis-based gay rights group, said, I will wake up on September 2nd the same way as September 1st and life will go on, but the fact of the matter is a million Missourians decided they know better how I should live my life than I do. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's just throwing a red herring up. I mean, the Constitution had nothing to do, the amendment had nothing to do about taking away any rights or any current activity that they're doing now. We didn't change a single thing, and they kept trying to depict it as such. All we're doing is just protecting our current policy. Life is not changed for them at all. People can live the way they want to, in sin or not, and you know, those choices are still available to people. We're just saying that the institution of marriage and the best, wisest public policy for Missouri should be and remain between a man and a woman. And that validates what we believe God founded in the beginning when he established marriages between a man and a woman. It's been a good plan. It served for over 5,000 years, and there's no reason to toss it out now.
Now, what happens if the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level is declared unconstitutional? Will that somehow put a monkey wrench into the works of not only the Missouri Act, but also this constitutional amendment?
Well, I'm not an attorney, but it would be very unsettling, and it is a concern of mine. Certainly, we are more protected now because we do have it in our Constitution. And so that certainly puts a level of protection in here in Missouri that another state who doesn't have that wouldn't. But with the full faith and credit clause of our current United States Constitution, which says that one state has to recognize the contracts and the legal proceedings of another state, then, you know, there are people out there already challenging the marriage law from Florida. The Defense of Marriage Act is being challenged by a gay couple who got married in Massachusetts, moved to Florida, and they want to demand the equal recognition there, and they're challenging the Defense of Marriage Act. So we're going to see a lot of these court procedures. I think the opponents of traditional marriage have found that the only way they can advance their cause is through the courts. When it goes to the people speak for traditional values, and they have very successfully used the courts, and they're going to continue those avenues to try to advance their narrow agenda. And it is very unsettling. That's why we must support a federal marriage amendment as well to clarify it at the federal level, or else in the future I am very concerned that we'll see a U.S. Supreme Court decision similar to Roe versus Wade that will impose the will of the U.S. Supreme Court justices on the entire nation.
How much do you think, finally, Vicki, how much do you think Missourians are, how much is their thinking reflected in the other 49 states when it comes to the issue of passing a U.S. constitutional amendment that would be similar to the one passed at the state level in Missouri? Do you think that Americans are thinking like Missourians there?
Well, I think at the state level, we are actually the fifth state to vote on it, four before the Massachusetts decision, and each one of those, whether it's Hawaii, Alaska, Nevada, or Nebraska, has been a 67% or higher approval rating. So people very much support it at the state level. I think there's some concerns, and unfortunately the other side has made some inroads arguing that there's not a need at the federal level. But when people understand there is a need there, people have an opportunity to affirm that, I think they will support it. And I hope that the United States Senate will get this message that people support traditional marriage and they will proceed with passing the federal marriage amendment. And I will add and ask people to pray for the week of September 20th. The House of Representatives is in the Congress is going to vote on the federal marriage amendment to try to pass it on the House side, send it over to the Senate again. So that's something that need to be in prayer about.
Vicki Hartzler is spokesperson for the Coalition to Protect Marriage in Missouri. Vicki, thank you for the update and thank you for being our guest.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Uwe Simonetto joins us for the remainder of this hour. We're going to be talking with him about Christians in Iraq. We're also going to talk about the Pope, who he is just seems to keep going and going. And he has written a column about, Sadr, the Pope, and Yogi Berra. We'll begin talking about Christians in Iraq in just a minute with him, Uwe Simonetto. In the second hour of the program, I remind you, Ken Samples will be our guest, part one of a three-part series on answering the objections of unbelievers. We're going to begin with very basic things in that second hour. We're going to be talking about the existence of God. How can you believe in a God that you can't see? How has this God revealed himself? If he can't be seen, he can't walk down the street and ring his doorbell and have a conversation with him in that way. How has he revealed himself? How important are the ancient Christian creeds today? And we'll also deal with some of the conundrums like the Trinity, things that people are befuddled by constantly. Ken Samples will be our guest of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center in the second hour of the program. Open Lines is in the third hour of the program. We'll be hearing from President George W. Bush. I mentioned a bit of his comments there on gay marriage. We'll hear his entire comment, which included something about the unborn as well. The president mentioned, if not by name, then at least by substance, both abortion and gay marriage. I had asked you before his address whether or not you expected him to address those two subjects. He did in one paragraph. I want to know whether it sufficed for you in the president's address at the Republican National Convention in New York on Thursday, and your general reaction to his hour-long speech in the third hour. Also, Alan Keyes gotten in a little trouble. He's running for the Senate in Illinois. He has the Illinois Republican Party rather miffed at him. I don't know how miffed they were before, but they're definitely miffed now. What did he do? Well, he said that Vice President Cheney's daughter was a hedonist. And he talked about homosexuality in those terms as well. Apart from the political aspect of this, completely apart from the political aspect of that. As a Christian, Alan Keyes, he would probably say the same thing, given what we know of him, if given the opportunity, even if he weren't running for Senate. Is this the way that Christians address the issue of homosexuality and gay marriage in the public square? Is this the best way, the most appropriate way, not to take issue with what he had to say about it, but is this the way we go about it? We'll be talking about it in the third hour of the program. Now, if you'd like to join us as we talk with Uwe Simonetto, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. While we wait for Uwe, let me tell you about our Issues Etc. book of the month for September. It's called Order Restored, and it's all about healing in the Bible. What can we learn from the healings that take place in the Bible? Is healing a universal promise made by God to all Christians, and can Christians expect daily miraculous healing? All of that is covered in our Issues Etc. book of the month for September. It's called Order Restored. It's $20.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Just look under the What's New section. You'll find the book, Order Restored. You can also go into one of two locations that Concordia Publishing House has in the St. Louis area, one at 3558 South Jefferson, 3558 South Jefferson, and the other at 801 DeMunn here in Clayton. It's on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in Clayton. All you have to do is follow the signs to the CPH bookstore. Ask for the book, Order Restored. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for September. And while you're there at both of those stores, I want you to look for something. We have Issues Etc. series on CDs at those two stores. You'll find them near the books where the CDs and the series deal with. Just look around, ask the clerk for the Issues Etc. series on CD, buy some, and thank the store manager for carrying these series on CD for you. Don't forget to ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for September, Order Restored. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from France for our Religion Roundup. Uwe, welcome back.
Wonderful to be back.
Uwe, let's start talking about the Christians in Iraq. First of all, many of our listeners might not be familiar with the fact that there is a Christian minority in Iraq. Tell us about it.
Yes, and they are indeed very interesting people. They are the descendants of the oldest civilization known. That's Mesopotamia. For thousands of years, so-called Assyrians have been known for their learning, their medicine, their philosophy. They were, in fact, the first ones to reach even Japan, to Christianize Japan. And they speak Assyrian, which is, of course, Aramaic, and very much related to the language spoken by Jesus.
You have written recently about Albert Yelda. Who is he, and what's been happening in the news surrounding him?
Well, Albert Yelda has been Albert Yelda is the future ambassador, Iraqi ambassador to the Vatican. He himself belongs to the ancient Church of the East. that is still independent from Rome, but getting moving closer to it. And he was a leading figure in the Iraqi exile community, in the opposition community. And he is pleading 40,000, you know, since the recent attacks on churches in Iraq, some 40,000 Iraqi Christians appear to have left Iraq, or at least Baghdad and south. And Yelda appealed to them, also, by the way, in the name of leading Muslim figures, to stay or to return. And indeed, some of those who had gone away are returning to Iraq, primarily to the Kurdish areas.
Now, you mentioned those attacks. There were four or five simultaneous attacks at or near churches in Iraq. Does this indicate that at least the mindset of the Iraqi people, who outnumber the Iraqi Muslims, who outnumber Iraqi Christians, 25-1 there, that they do not want a Christian population, that they would rather the Christians leave?
Well, no, these are, of course, the terrorists who do that. One has to be very careful. For example, my Iraqi Muslim friends, who are highly placed in the government there, and were highly placed in the opposition, and who are clerics, by the way, Shiite clerics, very much urge the Christians to stay. And it's very interesting that Muhammad himself had issued a letter or an order to leave the Christians in Iraq alone and for them, because he was so impressed by their learning and their philosophy and their scientific knowledge. So, I mean, there is an awareness there among your not run-of-the-mill, but, I mean, your responsible Muslims, that Christians, who make up a tiny minority, are essential for the well-being of a stable society and a healthy society in Iraq.
With only about 30 seconds before we go to our break here, Uwe, how did these Christians fare under Saddam Hussein?
Well, they were forbidden to speak their language, or actually they were, to teach their language to their children. Their schools were closed. They were persecuted under Saddam Hussein quite fiercely, and many of them fled primarily to the United States and to Europe. The largest community of Iraqi Christian exiles are around the Chicago and Detroit areas.
When we come back, more with Uwe Simonetta. We'll round off this first hour doing our religion roundup. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Pope, his last-minute intervention in Iraq, and Yogi Berra. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from France. More of that when we come back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does God still heal sickness, illness, and disease today? Of course he does. Does God still work miraculous healing? Yes. Does that mean that every Christian can exercise miraculous healing or expect miraculous healing for themselves? No. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September is called Order Restored, a Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing. In this book, you'll learn about healing in the Old Testament and the New Testament. You can order the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. You'll find Order Restored, a Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing. It's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September.
It takes patience and constant prayer to help children, but this Global Minute lets you hear that the reward is a changed life. Listen to this true story from India. Usha's parents died when she was tiny. Her uncle eventually brought her to live at the Ramabai Mukti Mission, where she settled with other children in a home called the Jasmine Family. Usha never had to follow rules at her uncle's, but suddenly she had to attend school, eat with others, and follow a bedtime routine. Usha's house mother prayed for her to adjust. Then Usha made friends with another orphan named Sarika. Sarika helped her learn the rules, and they've enjoyed listening to Bible stories and learning about Jesus Christ. Please pray Usha will yield to Christ. See Changed Lives in India on the new free video or DVD called Buds and Blossoms. Call 1-800-268-0461 and ask for Buds and Blossoms. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. On 80 secluded acres in metropolitan St. Louis, we faculty and students of Concordia Seminary today begin the 166th year of training pastors for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Secluded can present a problem. In 1884, Woodrow Wilson, then 28 years old, wrote to his future wife, "I'm afraid of being a mere student. I want to be part of the nature around me, not an outside observer of it. You will never find in a cloister a fulcrum for any lever which can budge the world." Wilson wasn't opposed to academia. Indeed, he served as president of Princeton University. What he feared was isolation from the pressing issues of the day. Academic seclusion easily becomes seduction into self rather than service, and when that happens, no fulcrum will be found to budge the world. But seek seclusion in order to engage societal issues wisely, and you will find fulcrums. One especially stands out in world history. Acts 4:13 says, "When they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished, and they took note that these men had been with Jesus." And what came from that seclusion with the wisdom of God and engagement with society? Acts 17:6 says, "They turned the world upside down."
A Walk for PKD will take place Sunday, September 19th at Crevecoeur Park to raise money to fight polycystic kidney disease, a common life-threatening genetic disease that affects over 6,000 people and their families in the St. Louis area. All proceeds benefit research to find a treatment and a cure. Registration for the walk begins at 10 a.m. The walk's at 11 on Sunday, September 19th at Crevecoeur Park. For more information or to register online, visit www.pkdcure.org.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series on Christianity and civil law with international human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Tomorrow we'll talk about the law and human cloning with Dr. Montgomery. Uwe Simonetto is our guest for the remainder of this hour, our religion roundup. He joins us from France. Uwe, a name that's been in the news a lot with regard to both Iraq and Iran, Sistani. Who is this man?
Well, Sistani is probably right now the most influential figure in Shiite Islam, the Shiite variety of Islam, and he is also the most influential figure, most powerful figure in Iraq. He has the rank of a Grand Ayatollah, which is the highest ranking, Grand Ayatollahs are the highest ranking clerics in Shiism, which they, and you know, a friend of mine described him as a pope and then said, well, wait a minute, a pope he's not because he is not elected by a college of cardinals. He has achieved this high status by learning. These guys study intensively for at least 20 years to even become as much as an Ayatollah, and he is one of the he is a top guy around.
Now, the politics of this is rather interesting, the demographics as well. While, as you write, Shiites only make up about 12% of worldwide Islam, in Iraq and in Iran, that's a very different story. They're in majorities, am I correct?
Well, absolutely, yes. In Iran, they are in an overwhelming majority. And in Iraq, which is where they have their holiest sites, they make up about 60%, some say even more.
Now, Sistani was in the news lately because, of course, he somehow, I was very hazy on this, he somehow was able to broker some kind of a truce with Muqtada Sadr there in Najaf. Tell us about it.
Well, he is so influential and he has so much authority that he actually managed to tell Muqtada, look, you stop this now and get out of the holy sites and make your militias lay down arms. And the interesting thing is, I mean, this Sistani is 73 years old, and he happened to be in London, recuperating from a very, very serious disease, and he managed to do that. I mean, just goes to show how powerful this guy is.
That raises the specter of an Iranian control, at least by some distance, and through its clergy of Iraq. Is that a real possibility?
Not really. I mean, not if Sistani has anything to say in this matter, because he is definitely opposed, even very much opposed to the Ayatollah Khomeini and the clerical ruler of now late Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran. Yes, there is an Iranian influence, like there is a Syrian influence, all sorts of other influences. But Sistani and his wing of Shiite Muslims would not be overly excited by Iran taking political influence. They are much more traditionalist, if you will, Shiites, sort of like Lutherans, separating the kingdoms.
So how would you draw the contrast for our listeners between, for those who hear Grand Ayatollah, they immediately think back to the 1970s, to Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah.
How would you draw the contrast between that figure and Sistani?
Well, I would say Sistani is, to begin with, is marked by great personal piety. He has been very reticent about exerting power, political power, because he did not really want to mix the two kingdoms. Except, of course, he also feels that if they behave like nutcases, as Muqtada al-Sadr did, it would also slow down or spoil the chances of the Iraqi Shiites to be in charge of their country after decades of playing second fiddle. But he himself is not really, by his own characteristics, he's not really a politician. But he did get involved in this particular case. Khomeini, as we all know, was, of course, influenced politics and was, of course, a political leader in addition to being a cleric.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. This is our Religion Roundup. We're coming to you live. It is Tuesday, the 7th of September. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You have also written recently, Uwe, about this headscarf law in France. You're going to have to explain that to us because it's mystifying to many. And it has actually come to the kidnap of two French reporters. We need an update on that as well.
Yes. The headscarf law actually is a misnomer. It's never been properly explained, especially not in the American media. First of all, it is not a headscarf law. It is France has this very rigid secularist doctrine, saying that we are rigidly neutral in spiritual matters, and so therefore they will not allow. This is a new law that were that prohibits children, school children, attending what you in America call public schools, state-owned schools, from wearing what they call ostentatious religious symbols. Now, and political symbols, let's not forget that, too. I mean, that is, applies there, too. That means that that you, as of last week, no children are no longer allowed to wear either headscarves, as Muslim girls did. Some Muslim girls, by the minority, most Muslim girls don't want to wear them anyway, not here in France. Or large crucifixes, small crosses, as one as women often wear, would be allowed, but not large, ostentatious, as they call it, crucifixes, or the Jewish skull cap, the kippah, or, for that matter, you know, if you happen to be a communist, hammer and sickle, or if you happen to be a monarchist, the fleur-de-lis symbols, or any of these things. So in all these matters, you're neutral. You can put your headscarf back on again the minute you leave school, that's fine. But in school, everybody is supposed to be equal, and therefore focusing on studying alone and not having any divisions, religious divisions, obvious religious divisions. Now, that has raised the most of the French, major French Muslim organizations have been griping about it, but nevertheless accepted it. And as their leader, in fact, said, the law is the law, and we just have to obey it, period. Now, then here comes this little terrorist group from in Iraq, kidnaps these two reporters and says we'll kill them if unless they rescind this law. And, of course, what they accomplished was the exact opposite. And instead of dividing France, for once France, which is a very divided country in many ways, was totally united behind the president, including the Muslim organizations, Christian, Jewish organizations, you name them, and said, we are not going to be blackmailed by these guys. So it's not happening. And now they are shifting gear. These two reporters are still somewhere in the hands of terrorists. And now they come up with other demands, but it is really yet another attempt. For example, one of the new demands is, well, all right, we'll release these guys if France agrees to sign a ceasefire, quote, ceasefire agreement with Osama bin Laden. And, of course, that's not going to fly either, because the French state is very, very tough about not allowing itself to be blackmailed by terrorists.
Now, how did this little terrorist group, the Islamic Army in Iraq, how did they justify at least their initial demand about this law? Is there any command in the Quran that women must wear a headscarf? Is it a Quranic command?
No, it's not. It would be a twist. No, it's not. You're supposed to be modest, yes, dress yourself modestly, not be too sexy in the eyes of other men. But no, there is in the Quran doesn't say anything about wearing a headscarf. Of course, in the other two monotheistic religions, you also have groups, Orthodox Jews, for example, that will not allow their women to show their own hair. You find Orthodox Jewish women, strict Orthodox Jewish women, wearing, for example, wigs above on top of their real hair. You have this example of nuns in the Roman Catholic Church hiding your hair. Hair is supposed to be alluring, which it is. I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than a wonderful woman's set of hair. But I mean, that is behind it. But it is no law. It's not a Quranic law.
This raises again the issue, Uwe, of what appears to be the growing Muslim population, not only in France, but in Germany and in Western Europe in general. Give us a brief overview.
Well, France, approximately 10% of the French population, between 8 and 10%, are Muslims, and they are growing. And there is, and in Germany, it's about 3 million out of a population of 82 million. Germany's a little it's easier. I mean, it's more relaxed in Germany than it is here. Here, the problem is that while the major Muslim organizations might be, or are, in fact, relatively moderate, the ghettos that used in the formerly communist suburbs of Paris and Lyon and others are heavily subverted by extremist Muslim preachers, who are very, very difficult to control and who preach hatred. And, of course, revive Islamism among the youth and who feel disenfranchised for a number of reasons, which I think has little to do with French policies, but it has something to do with the way they live in a parallel society, Muslim society, in a very secular France. So you have, on the one hand, attempts by the elite, the Muslim elite, to fit into French society. And indeed, if you travel around Paris or any of the major cities, you run into Muslims, including some very, very beautiful women who would definitely not be dressed with a headscarf or a chador or any of these things, who want to be simply French, and who are outraged about what the radicals are doing in the suburbs. But the suburbs is where the majority of the Muslims live, and they are exceedingly hostile to a Christian or a post-Christian, but Christian-influenced culture of France, and of course especially against the Christians, who still make up some 60-70% of the population, and indeed physically attack people all the time. Last year, for example, New Year's Eve, scores of these people, hundreds of these people, in fact, descended from the suburbs to the Champs-Élysées, the sort of the most beautiful boulevard in Paris, and smashing up shop windows and beating up people and all that sort of thing. So that is the trouble. The attempts to integrate them, attempts by both moderate Muslim groups and the state, have not so far succeeded.
Bringing much of what we've discussed already together, you have written a commentary recently wherein you quote, of all people, Yogi Berra.
Yes.
And his famous saying, of course, among all the famous things he had to say in his malapropisms, it ain't over till it's over. And you apply it to the situation of Pope John Paul II and his brief intervention also in Iraq. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, here the Pope, looking, of course, very feeble, came to Lourdes. He always looks feeble. I mean, he is in very much an advanced stage of Parkinson's disease. So, but he still mustered the strength to say mass and to preach and actually whisper to his aides in Polish, help me, I have to get through this. And so Cardinal Gottfried Danaos, he is the Archbishop of Brussels, said for the second time he felt that. The Pope wouldn't have much more, much longer to live. And then, of course, no sooner did he say that than the Pope offered to intervene. In fact, Sada asked the Pope to intervene in the fighting between Sada's people and the Americans and the Iraqi forces on the other side. And so I said, well, you know, that reminds me of Yogi Berra. Every time the Pope, somebody comes around saying the Pope is going to die soon, the Pope shows that he is certainly intellectually exceedingly active. And though his body is feeble, he musters the strength to see himself through. I mean, he's been to yet another pilgrimage in Loreto. He's been canonizing three people, not canonizing, beatifying three people. Next month he's going to beatify the last emperor of Austria-Hungary. I mean, the guy is very, very active. And so I said, well, that reminds me of Yogi Berra saying it ain't over till it's over. I mean, don't just jump to conclusions and presume God and say, well, you know, I know better, the guy is going to die. We don't know when he's going to die. And he will not stop being active as long as he can. This he said, because he said his example is Christ, who did not come down from the cross when he was suffering.
In the French context as well, you have noted that the Pope has felt the need to remind the French people, and in particular French President Jacques Chirac, of the need to remember their roots and the roots of their ideals in the French Revolution.
Yes, quite. I mean, all the ideals, first of all, I mean, that scene must have been absolutely spectacular. I've only seen pictures of it. I wasn't there. But this Pope with one eye open, you know, giving Chirac a piercing look, and the other eye, of course, closed by Parkinson, and reading Chirac, the Riot Act, because Chirac's the guy who prevents, who single-handedly is preventing the mention of Christianity's role in European civilization, or indeed of God in the European Constitution, which is being drafted. And so the Pope read him the Riot Act for 20 minutes at the airport of Tarbes, which is next to Lourdes. And he reminded him, of course, also of the fact, as he did when he was first crowned the Pope, that France was the first daughter of the Church, as it was called, as she was called then, and that her ideals, including the ideals of the French Revolution of 1789, liberty, equality, and fraternity or brotherhood, have all Christian roots and none other. And that has, whenever the Pope does that sort of thing, it has, and in me, gives it a sort of shock to French society. I think he has a powerful impact on the French, because he's very well liked. The youth are following him by the hundreds of thousands. I mean, can you imagine this ancient Pope, and here are these very attractive young people, and wherever he shows up, they surround him and listen to him. So the Pope's visit to France was once again, it may have been the last one indeed, or may not have been the last one. I'm not going to be Cardinal Danneels saying that, but the Pope made absolutely sure that the French remembered who they were, where they came from, that they were that their country is the first daughter of the Church, and had done amazing, because of this, had contributed amazingly to Western culture.
And finally, with the last few minutes left to us, Uwe, you have written an analysis piece about goings-on in Venezuela, in particular,
yes,
regarding Hugo Chavez, the president there. He himself, an avowed Roman Catholic, although you say that the officials in Venezuela of the Church are not particularly happy with him. Tell us about it.
Well, Chavez is one day is one thing, the next day is another. Yes, he is, of course, a member of the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church is very unhappy with him, especially since he attended a mass read by or celebrated by a communist priest. But the more fascinating thing is that Chavez has always seen himself as a follower, a disciple of Simon Bolivar, who was, of course, the liberator of South America, and indeed at some point considered himself the reincarnation. And there is a cult called Maria Leonza. We don't have the time to describe it all. It would be a wonderful story at one point. But this cult venerates Bolivar as one of the people whose soul, which is in transit in their ideology from one body to another, they believe in reincarnation, can be appealed to for guidance. So then the next thing you know is that when Chavez was elected, his bust appeared on the altars of this particular sect, which is quite large. It affects about 20 million, up to 20 million people, and one third of the 20 million Venezuelans. So his bust appeared there. And then next thing you know is that some of those temples removed his bust, saying, well, no, he is actually a fraud. He can't be the reincarnation of Simon Bolivar. And now they're deeply divided over whether he is or whether he is not, whether he can be appealed to or not. Also, of course, a little illogical that someone who is dead could also be appealed to while he's already incarnate in another body. Then, of course, logic doesn't apply to that particular religion.
It's difficult for us to understand, given the fact that what we're dealing with here, it sounds like, Uwe, with only a minute left, is a strange mixture of South American politics and then, again, another mixture of various religions and kind of New Age ideas.
Yes, but that's religion dates back to the idea dates back to the 19th century, and there was a French teacher who wrote under the name of Alan Kardec, and who developed this idea that this notion that souls can be appealed to while in transit from one incarnation to the next, and that became very fashionable among the upper classes, both in Western Europe and in Northern South America. And then filtered down, of course, mixed with Roman Catholicism and tribal religions, and filtered down finally the lowest of classes, who live in the barrios, for example, around Caracas in Venezuela, and they probably are nowhere as powerful as they are in Venezuela.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joined us from France for our religion roundup. Uwe, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
When we come back from this break, Ken Samples joins us for the first part of a three-part series. We're going to begin it in this next hour, answering the objections of unbelievers. Today we're going to talk about the existence of God. Some basic questions like, how can you believe in a God that you can't see? What about this conundrum presented by the Christian teaching of the Trinity, a God who is both three and one, not three gods, one God, yet three persons? The unbeliever is going to look at that and say, nonsense. We'll find out whether that's true from Ken Samples in the next hour, and we'll also talk about whether or not the ancient Christian creeds belong in ancient history. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.